the fright that we should have as a society is, seriously, we're making policy decisions right now and trying to gain influence by presenting data by a computer that just makes stuff up.
Welcome to the Enterprise Intelligence Podcast with CEO Shiny Docs, Jason Cassidy, and VP Customer Success, Davey Sliman. Well, gentlemen, it's great to be back after a bit of a two-week hiatus. How are you guys doing?
Well, it's summer now, and the days are officially changing the length of time. I like when we get to this part of the year because the idea of staying up until 9 p.m. when the sun's up, it's energizing. You get up in the morning at whatever time the sun's up. It is almost, I don't blame people who go south for the winter to be able to experience more sunshine. And this is definitely working for me.
You know, I think you know this, guys. I'm a kind of an extreme early bird. Something flipped for me in my early 30s where I stopped being kind of a night owl and I started getting up like a farmer. And this time of year, I absolutely love it because I get up and I've got coffee and I've got my day started usually doing some housekeeping, calendaring, emailing, that kind of stuff on my back porch. It's beautiful. The sun's up, the squirrels are running around, and yeah, love it. And for me, I agree that the evenings with light is great, Jason, but I love the mornings. It's nice and cool, kind of quiet. It's just the best. Yeah.
Love it. So yeah. Yeah, this week I thought we'd hop into something that I wanted to talk a little bit about the hype cycle of AI, and because I always want to try to understand what the triggers are for the decline or the increase of these types of things, and so there's one subtle trigger that I thought was interesting this week. And it was a tweet by a member of parliament here, and they were talking about the capital gains tax, and they used ChatGPT as their reference material. And of course, ChatGPT had an hallucination or lied or whatever, and so it gave wrong data. And of course, it's included as part of this. So, and of course, the fright that we should have as a society is, seriously, we're making policy decisions right now and trying to gain influence by presenting data by a computer that just makes stuff up. So it should that be considered a jump the shark moment? Not on the global scale, but I mean, the more paper cuts we get like this, isn't it a reminder that there is obviously AI, there's massive cool things specific that we can do with it. And it's obviously we promote that as part of our software and all that. But the bigger question is, as far as this just generalized hype around AI, isn't this just a reminder that it's like, hey, it's not going to do everything that everybody was hoping it was going to do. So let's just back off and find practical uses for it.
Oh gosh. I mean, I really hope that that's the way some people respond to it. I think, you know, I love the paper cut analogy. What I love about it is, you're not saying, and I don't think any of us are saying, that AI doesn't have its place and AI isn't, in fact, that we are not, in fact, on this inexorable march towards the increased use of AI over the course of the next several decades, because I think we are. And I'm not sticking my neck out to say that I think that this is the march that we're on. But what you're saying, I think, is that we're going to, just like a lot of new tech that gets introduced, we're going to have some bumps in the road, and those bumps should be enough for us to at least pause and say, we need to come up with a better way of doing this or a better way of handling that. Now, I worry that we don't have a great, when I say we, I mean humanity. Humanity doesn't have a great track record of, you know, slowing down and evaluating things that need evaluation. But I hope that it is something that we do consider. I was thinking about it a lot in the context of like other new tech that the three of us have all lived through. You know, like whether it's you know, the whole jump from an analog world to a digital or web-based world, or even the one that I think is more, in some ways was more impactful, was the jump from us being locked to a desk somewhere in an office to the mobile experience, and the jump that mobile computing introduced that we now like completely, like we're all completely bored by the idea of mobile computing. But every once in a while I go somewhere with my phone or, you know, a tablet or something, and I watch a movie. It's like, well, I'm going to go down to the workshop and watch a video or something. And I'm not, it's amazing to me that I'm not completely amazed by that. I've become completely bored by it. But my point in bringing up the jump from, you know, kind of the static workspace to the mobile work world is simply to call out that even during that, there were all kinds of paper cuts and bumps in the road that we encountered from a security perspective, from a performance perspective. There was a whole range of, if you recall, a whole range of, investigations and research into, you know, whether or not the Wi-Fi signals are giving us cancer, and all of these things that we continue to, you know, kind of step on. And my point is simply that they didn't stop the march forward, but in a lot of cases they did cause governing bodies, jurisdictions, governments, etc., to bring in controls to kind of manage these things. And I think AI may, if it isn't already, may soon be having those moments as well, particularly when it comes to things like, you know, personal privacy and security and the like. So at least I really hope it is. The good news seems to be that governments around the world do seem to be diving headfirst into it, doing their best to understand what AI is, what some of the apparent benefits are, and what some of the apparent risks are. And so hopefully from that, some policy outcomes can come from it, which would lead to, you know, either regulations or legislation, or, you know, even just voluntary codes of behavior.
It's interesting that you talk about that, because, like, I mean, I've been in these meetings. I've been in the ICED meetings, other things, talking about this, and our name, Shiny Docs, my name is on some of these things. And I'm not bragging, it's just kind of my opinion as part of it. And it's almost like you can't even make a policy, right? I get there's some bases that you can have as far as policy making goes, like don't steal information as a data, like you have to respect copyright, you have to respect privacy, like those are kind of basal kind of things. But when you take the next step with it, like when I consider the hype cycle around blockchain is a great one. Blockchain has one fantastic use, and that is a bunch of people can vote on whether or not they think something happened in the past. And it is a very reliable way of saying this thing happened in the past, because if everybody votes on the same computation, then we all agree this thing happened in the past, like a financial transaction. So it works great, because it sucks that if I owe Davey a certain amount of money, I buy $1 million worth of services from Davey, the only way for me to get you that $1 million is through intermediary banks who charge as much as they want, hold your money as long as they want. Like it's real, like the financial system that we have right now is just dirt crap compared to what it could be if we had a distributed ledger, blah, blah, blah. So, however, the banks say, whoa, but we make sure that your data's safe and all that. However, I mean, how much do you see in the news of banks saying, whoa, we weren't party to that transaction. That is you were dumb enough to e-transfer somebody something and you didn't get the service. Screw you. So it's funny that the talk track that is there is it's secure and blah, 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 which I don't doubt. Like, obviously, there's massive security associated with it. But the convenience that we're trying to get with respect to blockchain should be there, but that's the only thing it does. So it's good. The beauty of mobile is it also, we knew the only thing it does is convenience. Okay. So when I think of blockchain, it's a convenience of being able to give something to Davey, a bunch of people vote. They said, yeah, that happened. So we all agree it happened. With respect to mobile, it's a convenience of I can do my banking here. I can do, instead of having to go to 10 different stores and whatever. I get the convenience of doing something right now in any context, as long as I have a reasonable amount of connectivity. So then when it comes to AI, it's this amorphous blob of ambiguity as to, is it giving me convenience? Is it actually getting me fired? Is it what the hell is this thing? And that's the problem, is it's everything to everybody all the time, everywhere, all at once, rather than let's just pick out the one thing that it's good at, like blockchain.
Yeah, boy, holy moly. Yeah, I think you're really onto something there, because, you know, I think early on I could have explained mobile clear. Well, I remember doing it, you know, explaining the advantages of a smartphone to my mom and dad, who at the time were in their early 60s, when the, you know, kind of like the very first, whether you think of it as like the, you know, my first smartphone was actually a BlackBerry, but for a lot of people it would have been an iPhone or something like that, where, you know, you have connectivity to the world on your phone wherever you are nearly in the world, and an ability to get things done on your phone. And I remember showing my dad one holiday I was home, and I was, you know, I think it was a BlackBerry Bold or something really cool, you know, something fancy at the time with the real tactile keyboard. And I remember doing like a little demo to my mom and dad, who had seen, you know, flip phones and stuff like that. But like in the days of flip phones, my parents couldn't have been talked into that. They were, you know, they didn't see, other than, you know, we're going to have a little phone for, you know, roadside emergencies or things like that. There was nothing for them. But once you were able to show them the kind of app view of the world from your phone, and you can get things done, you can order a pizza, you can buy a t-shirt, you can do all these things. Right then and there, my dad especially, a little less so with my mom, my dad especially was like, okay, this is, you know, this is really cool. I'm on board with this. I might be interested in something like this. Now, in his case, I think they went and, because that was sort of the dawn of the tablet as well. And I think in their case, they went and got a tablet. I don't really feel like right now, at least, AI as it's represented popularly, because, you know, it's represented popularly as a time-saving tool for knowledge workers and creatives, and particularly stuff related to large language models and that kind of thing, right? So I don't think I can take that same conversation to a non-technical person, whether it's your parents or your grandparents. I don't think I can take that same conversation to my mom right now and say, oh, mom, you should totally be doing AI so that you can, write some technical documents faster, or come up with a PowerPoint template faster. I'm not totally sure. To your point, I'm not totally sure what we're selling to people right now, because it's all of the things. It's like, it's everything. It's going to make everything faster and better. Okay, like specifically what? Well, you can make a picture that looks like five other pictures based on pictures that you show it. Okay, cool. All right. Do I need to do that? Is that something I got to do right now? I mean, it's fun. You know, I can make, you know, draw me a picture that's, you know, Mickey Mouse, you know, surfing down the Nile in ancient Egypt, and AI can go and make that. And I guess that's cool. I needed that. I don't know.
So I like this ideation that we're doing. And I mean, we could spend all day doing this, and the audience probably will like it at first and then hate it afterward. But it's, yeah, the idea of saying, oh, here's a specific thing that it's useful for. Here's a specific thing that it's useful here. Here's a specific thing that it's useful for. That to me is, you know, on the other side of the shark that we're jumping with this thing right now. It's just making it so real and so obvious that here's the specific use cases where it helps you. And it is massive help. Like, I get that animation studios right now are redesigning the way that they think around these new capabilities. That makes sense. Whereas, you know, a service technician who needs to roll a truck to go fix a pump somewhere, it's a little bit more ambiguous as to what the exact thing is that where AI is going to help them. Like, I would articulate that AI is the thing that is going to go and identify the documents that they need to do their job so that they don't have to roll the truck more than once. That they have everything that they need and I could perhaps be predictive about a pump like this tends to fail in the following way. Okay, good. So, but it's, yeah, there's no generic AI use case, yet we keep talking about it generically. Yes. And I think that's why it's just, we're kind of driving the generic talk should just die at some point in favor of the specific things that we're getting as society, because
AI is just doing it. I really like that, because you're right. It's all very generalized right now. Even in the, you know, you talked about the hype train, even the marketing language that, you know, companies use to kind of get people excited about it. It's not often that you go to, you know, some vendor's website where they talk very specifically about what the AI, their interpretation of an AI solution is going to specifically do. But I think you're right. I think it needs to get to that point, you know. So for a company like ShinyDocs, you know, when we look at, you know, what people really struggle with, you know, the big thing that comes to mind right off the bat is the sheer volume of data that has long eclipsed individual human beings' ability to stay on top of it. So whether it's, you know, individual human beings or even groups of human beings' ability to classify data into groups and say, these are all HR documents and these are all accounts payable documents and these are all, you know, engineering documents or engineering diagrams, that at a super basic level, but it's basic, but it's also specific. Then I think the other thing that's like really interesting that we know that we can do and should start to talk about more specifically with people is, okay, not only can you get to the point with AI where you're classifying massive amounts of documents in aggregate, but you're also able to interrogate that data in ways that you're not used to today. You know, so you know, traditionally you would use computers. Companies would come to ShinyDocs and other companies like ShinyDocs to say, I've got all this data and I need a search engine to put in front of it so that I can, you know, do full text searching, which is great. And, you know, we do that. We can do lots of that. But what we are talking about here is not just an ability to say, you know, show me every document that has the occurrence of this word or that word, but why don't you tell me what this set of documents is about, you know, and create for me an abstract or a series of abstracts about all, you know, so I understand what each of these documents are about. Or more specifically, if we're going for specific examples, why don't you read this document that's 600 pages long that I don't have time to read, and I need you to pull out specifically answers to these four things, because I don't have time to read 600 pages. Yeah. But my boss just said, what's the calculation for this? What's the answer for that? Blah 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 blah. You go look at that document, Mr. AI or Mrs. AI, and come back in 3 seconds with the answer, because I can't do that in any kind of reasonable time.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, what I like to ask about that, Davey, and maybe we can bring this part of the conversation to a point, is you landed on something that our software is doing. So that's cool. I'm excited about that. Yeah, the more customers that we get, you know, that understand their data better and can clean up their information and make it more widely available to their organization so that they get the so that everybody in the organization can find what they need, as opposed to having to go to somebody else. I mean, that's the big win. But yeah, I like the next step, which we're introducing, and that's the ability to ask for this data set in my search result. Just tell me how much money was in this contract. Tell me this or that. And the AI is great at doing that. Awesome use case in that. And I'm hoping that that's good enough for people, because the whole generic idea of everything everywhere, well, you're using AI, it should be able to do anything. Like, yeah, no, these the specific things that we're going to do, which are still
specific
awesome.
Examples and specific use cases, you know. There's this giant contract, and in the contract, I want to know, I don't have time to read it all, but in the contract, I want to know, how much were the professional services charges in May of 2021? I don't have time. Like, I really don't have time to read through this document and find that. So tell me how much we charged for professional services in May of 2021. Oh, it was blah. Good. Great. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And computers are very good at that. It is a good enough use case. It's an obvious time saver. It's an obvious convenience. And now we just brought it back in line with mobile computing.
Yeah,
and the other things that we agree with.
Yeah.
This is useful. You can explain that to your parents. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the convenience, the workplace corollary to convenience is productivity. Like there's an overlap, obviously, right? You're making something faster, easier, less obtrusive, and therefore theoretically making people more productive. And we know that, we have a productivity challenge here.
Well, it's, and I want to jump on this because this is something like we like bragging about our friends at Town of Milton. We like bragging about our friends at Dunedin City Council. These were innovators who've been with us for a few years now and way down the road as far as being ahead of the rest of the pack with respect to information management. And so I'm in a presentation. It's Milton doing the presentation in front of 750 of their peers. And they were talking about the first 2,000 searches that were done on Shiny Docs, on DocuSearch, as they call it. And they did an audit to look to see, okay, how long did people spend searching? These 2,000 searches ended up taking a total for all the people that did the first 2,000 searches, 19 minutes, an average response time of 0.6 seconds. So that's pretty good. So 2,000 searches, 19 minutes total, 0.6.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty awesome. That's computer speed. And then they went back and did an audit of this to say, how long would it take? So they looked at each of the discrete searches and how long would it take to find this? How long would it take to find that? And they actually tried a few of them. And their spot checks, adding up all the time to go find those documents, they said at minimum is 175 hours. And they said maximum probably around 550 or something. Yeah. So that's a mic drop. So to replace even the best case of 175 hours replaced with 19 minutes, how much money is that? Because humans cost money. Like, how much money is that? 175 hours replaced with 19 minutes. And now that just rolls for these customers over and over and over again, every day, every year. It's just, how much time they save.
I'll get teased until I'm an old man about, being kind of soft on these topics, but I yes, it's obviously a huge productivity thing. It's a huge money and time saver, time and money being basically the same thing. But I get really caught up in the human parts of this and what that means for people doing their jobs, right? Like, yes, you can get a lot more done when you're finding something in, milliseconds versus, hours or days, et cetera. But, for the people who have those roles and who have this as their job, what does it do for their own enjoyment of their job, for their own satisfaction, especially for somebody who works, for a citizenry, for somebody who works for a municipality? It means a lot to them to be able to do their job well and to do it quickly and productively. And so I don't think that should be lost either. So like this whole idea that, tech and AI is this inevitable march towards, it's only about, reducing costs and getting rid of jobs, et cetera. People are very obviously stressed about it. But you and I have talked about this before, including in this podcast, about how it's also about, improving the quality of the work that people are doing and their own engagement with their jobs. So I don't know. I get stuck on that as well. It's a big part of it.
Yeah, it's like Tom Petty said, the waiting is the hardest part. And that hits to me is that it's just anytime there's a wait state in any system, it's bad. It's just if I ask something of my municipality, of my lawyer, of whatever, the faster I get a response and the more accurate I get a response, the more satisfied I'm going to be, because then I move, then there's no wait state for me because there's somebody waiting on me for this. So this cascade of wait states, it's like traffic. You know what I mean? Like traffic happens because traffic happens. And that, so when we remove one wait state out of any of this chain of information that people need, all of a sudden traffic starts flowing. Like it's just in productivity-wise.
It's just better for everybody, right? So, and then it's, and to extend it out, then, the citizens of a municipality, they feel as though they're getting their money's worth from their you know, tax dollars, right? So it's like, yeah, you know, my city runs well. I had a question from my city about my property or the water or the sewers or parking or whatever it happened to be. I had a question about it and I got the answer right away. It wasn't weeks and me following up 1,000 times because nobody's got time for that. You know, ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a good spot to wrap
well,
up. All right, David.
Man. So, all right, let me start by saying, this is a topic that I'm completely fascinated by. I've maybe always been a little bit fascinated by it. And we've talked around this a few times, but I wanted to call out something I read really recently from a company, or I guess an organization, not really a company, called the Edelman Trust Institute. Have you ever heard of the Edelman Trust Institute? It's a firm that, you know, for the most part, their whole reason for existing is that they essentially do research with their business partners and other organizations to help other organizations understand the loyalty that stakeholders and customers have with their brands, the reputation that customers have with their brands. And the thing that they're really interested in, it's in the name of their institute, is trust. You know, what are the components of a trusting relationship that people have with an organization or a government or a company? And it's this whole topic is super interesting to me. And they released what they call the 2024 Edelman Trust Barometer, which is kind of this large survey across sectors and across regions to look at who out there is trusted and to what degree is that trust getting better or worse. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing. And, you know, I'm sure there's probably a paid version. You can get like a lot of the data and a lot of the details, but there's some really interesting things that have come from this research that they've done. And I wanted to call it out because some of it was also a little bit surprising to me and also concerning, right? So, you know, I kind of, as a lifelong, you know, software guy and somebody who's been working in tech for my whole career, like yourself, I kind of expected to learn that the tech industry, for example, would have a terrible trust rating, that, you know, people don't trust tech, and that's just the way it is. There's this long history of folks not trusting technology, and that actually isn't the case. That's not true at all. But what is true, in fact, the general ratings for the tech industry in terms of trust are actually quite high. They're in the mid 70s, 75 or 76% of, you know, trust in technology. But what is interesting is that, in, you know, you have to be more, you know, back to your previous comment, you have to be more specific, because when you dive into it, it gets kind of even more kind of complicated, right? So for example, tech has a 76% general trust rating, but only 50% of survey respondents say that they trust this sector on artificial intelligence. Healthcare, similarly, has a 73% trust rating, you know, really high, but it's only 50 when it comes to things like genetically modified food or gene-based medicine such as mRNA. And I promise I'm really not trying to introduce politics into this chat, and we're not going to do that today. But what was interesting to me was some of the Edelman Trust Institute also had some prescriptions out there of saying, okay, well, this is all really interesting. We know a little bit about who and what is trusted out there. We can benchmark it against previous surveying that we've done to see what's in decline and what's getting better. But what do we actually do about it? And they had a whole list of sort of prescriptions for how to deal with this, but there were a couple that kind of jumped out at me. Interestingly enough, compared to government leaders and journalists and reporters, business actually had higher trust ratings than some of those folks. not a lot higher, but higher, right? So, you know, that folks have increasingly, and this is concerning, have increasingly begun to trust the popular media less than they would trust, for example, a corporation on an individual topic. Because the assumption, I think, is that a corporation is always going to act in its own interests, for the profit motive and the own health of their business. And therefore, they're in a better situation to clearly articulate something than somebody who's politically motivated and just trying to win the next election. But the prescriptions that they gave were to say, you know, given the high level of trust in the business community compared to other places, that then puts businesses like ShinyDocs, like all kinds of other companies, in a very unique position to kind of lead the charge in what they call ethical innovation, right? To be transparent, to be communicative, to be kind of out front and open about what you're doing. So you know, if I think about, bring it back into the conversation we just had, but also just bring it back into the direction of ShinyDocs, I think that one of the things that we can and should be doing is not just saying, hey, here are the specific cool AI things you can do with ShinyDocs, but here is our ethical position on this topic. Here is the stand that we're taking, because this is important to take seriously, right? So I wanted to, it's, you know, classic, enterprise intelligence, in a classic way, we've come full circle to a kind of a shared topic, but I wanted to get kind of some initial feedback on these items and hear what you have to say.
It's cool. I'm going to take it in a funny direction. And as I think about trust, and you start talking about like what we perceive as like people wouldn't trust or whatever, I think back to like Bonhoeffer during World War II, and it's probably familiar with him. Just the idea that people who follow people, unfortunately, if you park your thinking with somebody else, then you're kind of at their mercy. So if they're doing something stupid, then you're doing something stupid. And we can think of lots of examples during human conflict where you look back and it's like, how did so many people believe that thing and want to follow that thing? Well, I mean, that's just the way humans work, is they're tribalist and these types of things. So I'm going to introduce one more name, and I may have talked about this before, and this is Cipolla. This is, I believe it's Italian. And I don't know much about him, but he has this matrix, and the matrix that he puts out there has two dimensions in it. Dimension number one is whether or not you're helping other people or whether or not you're helping yourself. So you put that on one line.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there's another dimension of it's kind of the same idea if I'm helping others. Okay. So are you helping yourself and are you helping others? Those are the two dimensions.
Sorry, no, I'm with you. I'm still with you.
Combine them. So that you're helping yourself. So if you help yourself and you're helping others, that puts you up in this quadrant called intelligent people or win-win people. Okay. Right. And for the most part, you know, lots of businesses, especially early ones, every early business is a win-win business. Otherwise you can't win over a crowd of people. So you win as a customer. I win by getting your money. We both provide a lot of value. Boom, 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 boom. Up it goes. And then all of a sudden things switch. It turns into the inshittification, where at some point there's no more win left for the consumer in there. So the business starts screwing them over, and that puts them in the it's good for the business but bad for the consumer thing. But that's a quadrant that everybody sees coming. It's called the bandit quadrant. Okay. So the bandit quadrant, and you can think of lots of people who are bandits. They want you to lose so that they can win. So you can see them coming a mile away. And we actually trust bandit organizations. So Ticketmaster is a bandit organization. It's a monopoly, blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to make it political. We'll let the politicians figure out what they want to do with Ticketmaster. Short story long is you can see the anti-consumer behavior that they do, in my opinion. So they're down there in the bandit. So we actually trust them in as much as they are reliable in what they're doing. In fact, I don't even
buy a ticket. You get the ticket. You go to the concert.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like it's even when you think back to the threats against Microsoft, and you got Bill Gates sitting up there in front of Congress saying it's like you wouldn't ask for Coke to add one Pepsi to every six pack of Coke. And like, it's just, they're upfront about it. Well, of course we're trying to build a monopoly. Like, they're bandits. That's just what they do. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's predictable. And that's why you can trust them.
Interesting.
Regardless of whether that trust is. Yeah. So those two are fine. Win-win, win-lose. I can trust either because I know what their game is. Where it gets weird, and this is where Cipolla says, is people who make consistent decisions that are bad for themselves, but good for other people, those are hapless people. Those are people who get taken advantage of. And there's a lot of people who get exploited out there. And I mean, again, without being political, like we can just say, it's like, that's harder to predict. What are people who are easily exploited going to do? It's hard to have trust there because you just don't know. And then the worst column, the toughest one, is the one in the bottom, which is people who make bad decisions for themselves, and those bad decisions are bad for everybody else, which Cipolla called in whatever, it's in Italian, stupid people. And he said, unfortunately, there's more stupid people than anything else. And I'm not saying that people are stupid. What I'm saying is that we all have a hard time, back to Bernoulli and everything else, of deciding what positivity are in my decision making. What it's you know, like, what's the payback of the bet that I'm making right now? People have a real hard time estimating, you know, what a good decision is. So they tend to wind themselves in. So in where I'm headed with this is it's impossible to trust what I'm going to call things that reliably make bad decisions for themselves and everybody else. It's just impossible to figure that out. It's ineffable. It's ineffable to figure out people who constantly make bad decisions for themselves that help everybody else out. So that's why companies always tend to be over on the other side. They're either, you know, win-win companies, which tend to be growth companies, tend to be ones that are really helping their customers. And then eventually they switch to be bandits because there's nothing left for their customers and their customers become the product. But they're all predictable and they're all over there, because if a company is truly stupid,
yeah,
they're going
to
go out of business.
They don't get to that point because they have. Yeah. Interesting. I'd never heard. So
yeah.
I've got some reading to do. So I'll hit you up for some links and stuff afterwards. But you know, that's a really interesting matrix that I think totally lands into the Edelman Trust Institute stuff that I started with, which is the part of it that was surprising to me was that corporations score well. But now, given what you've said, it actually makes sense. It's like, from a trust perspective alone, they score well, right? I trust that when I go get a bottle of Coke, we feel like we're picking on Coke, go get a bottle of Coke, it's going to be delicious and cold and bubbly and all these things. And, you know, I might not like them as a corporation. I might even intellectually know that this thing is bad for me, but I still, man, every once in a while, although I'm a kind of a Coke Zero guy, I'll still go and get a delicious freezing cold Coke at the gas station because it's good. It does something for me, and they get something for me. They get my money, right? So, you know,
yeah. So it's maybe in a sense they're kind of a health bandit, but who cares? They're a dopamine win-win. They're a dopamine win-win for sure. And maybe they're a bit of a health bandit. So it allows you to literally have 100% trust in them, that it's going to be a reliable experience. And I don't even want to pick on Ticketmaster. I'd love to have their market cap. You know what I mean? And it's, but it is, they are 100% reliable in that if I check my ticket and it's in the Ticketmaster app, I go to hockey games, I go to concerts and stuff like that, I've gotten in 100% of the time. It's 100% reliable service. Exactly. Yeah. It's whether or not it's 100% ethical or whether it's good for society, again, let a politician figure that out. But in the meantime, so I get it. I get why corporations who generally deliver the service that they promise would have a high trust score, because regardless of whether you think they're good for society or not, who cares? You know that you're going to get the product in the manner in which you expect it.
I think there's sorry to chime in here, guys, but I think there's an interesting layer in this also, where do you think like product recalls affect trust in company? Because when I look at that, I don't really think it does. Like, you know, when you get a letter from Ford or from Mazda or whatever, that there's been a recall on a part in your car, you just take it in and they fix it. And then like, I never think, well, I'm never going to buy that brand ever again, because like they had to recall, obviously there was a quality problem. Or even, you know, say like McCain or a big food company like puts out a recall on like, oh, this something or other is contaminated, you worry about it in the moment, but then it's like, I keep buying that product. Like, I'm not like, oh, I can't ever buy that again because that one time there was E. coli in the spinach or whatever, right? So yeah, it is really interesting to me that we, to Jason, to your point, we do have that kind of like unwavering trust in kind of what I would say is like almost like product corporations, right? Because on the flip side, I think there's, and I know you guys weren't really talking about this and we're trying to keep politics out of it, but when you look at, I think, trust in like what's considered establishment companies, sure, especially like the media, is yeah, like at a record low, right? Yeah. So it's like, you know, you're, if your product maybe is delivering the news, people not so much trusting that. But if you're delivering, you know, the new iPhone, everybody's on board.
Yeah, like so certain things just fall into the stupid category, which includes doing things that are unlawful. Like if you intentionally do something unlawful, Enron, it's easy to pick on them because they're all dead or in jail. But I mean, more recently, Boeing. And I'm going to say 99% of the people at Boeing are wonderful people who have sincere intent to create a great, safe product. And then there's 1% of the people who unfortunately had lots of control that ended up, you know, controlling whether or not they use dish soap instead of grease on doors and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's just, I think it comes down to intent. So if there's an intent to try to be win-win, then you get credit for being win-win. And if there's an intent to try to deliver a good product, but be a bit of a bandit, then you're okay. But I'm not going to say some of the decisions that are coming out about Boeing. And again, I want to still sell software to Boeing. I like, let's say 99% of it's there. I'm not trying to pick on them, when you slip into the doing unlawful things or dangerous things or stupid things, if I'm going to use simple as little matrix, then all of a sudden that's an automatic spot to erode trust. I don't think for a second that E. coli on, you know, spinach was intentional. Nobody tried to poop on the spinach. It just happened. We clean it up. We move on. But if somebody intentionally said, hey, I can get a steep discount on poop based spinach and still pass it off as good, then like, I mean, obviously that should destroy your confidence for the consumer.
Well, I have a little bit of a counterpoint to that, Jason, and sorry, Davey, to cut you off, but I think, you know, and I could be wrong on this, but I think there's data that supports looking at companies again, like Apple or Samsung, whatever, who make devices, that devices are generally made with a specific lifespan in mind, like deliberately, so that like after 2 years, your phone dies, you go buy the new one. Yet people are still trusting in that and like lining up to get, you know, the new hotness every time. But it's kind of accepted that, you know, I guess that's like a deliberate kind of malpractice that, you know, they're not looking to build things that last for 40 years because they're going to put themselves out of business, right? Like no one's going to need to buy new things unless you're looking to buy the newest thing, right?
Yeah, sorry to dominate, but I mean, it's the Phoebus cartel. If you want to look at something funny, back in 1925 to 1939 was the group, and I pulled up the article here, Tungsram, General Electric, Associated Electrical Industries, Philips, everybody conspired to create labs that they would all put their light bulbs in. And if their light bulb lasted too long, it would get rejected. So they actually made sure, and as a group, ensured that all their light bulbs were not as good as they could be, so that they would make sure there was the steady opportunity for all of their cartel companies to sell light bulbs, which kind of, I don't know if that invented planned obsolescence. I feel like that's always been a thing. But the idea of planned obsolescence is, again, it's a bandit thing. I throw that in bandit. That's reliable. When you buy a Samsung, again, I want to sell the Samsung. I'm not trying to pick on anybody, but it's my Samsung washing machine is not quite as good as the Kenmore one that came with my house that lasted for 20 years. And you buy the Samsung one and it lasts for 3 years. So it's just, you know, this planned obsolescence thing feels like a bandit thing rather than a stupid thing.
Yeah. And all I was going to add to Steve's original comment about recalls is, you know, Steve started with recalls is, you know, as a lifelong customer support guy, it's not about trust in you and trust in your organization is not about whether your product has problems or doesn't have problems at all. It's about how you respond to them, right? It's about how you as an organization respond. No, nobody buys software expecting for there never to be a bug. Really, truly, nobody. buys enterprise level software and expects it to be perfect 100% of the time. What they expect is for it to do the things that you said that it was going to do. And if they find anything that isn't working the way that they thought it was going to, if it's not working well, that you're going to be responsive and fix it quickly, and everybody gets to move on, because then you're in the win, you're back in win-win, you know, you're back in it. You're not acting like a bandit. You're acting in good faith. You're taking care of the thing that the customer found or reported. And so that's why, you know, when I get a recall for my car, you know, I understand that auto companies have to do that, but secondly, it's like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. You're doing the thing that you're supposed to do, which is you know, my air conditioner fan has a screw that sometimes falls out and you've got to put in a new screw that doesn't fall out or something. Like, you're doing the thing that I expect you to do. So we're back in a win-win situation, you know? So I've got some reading to do. I'm really excited about this, but each of the examples, Jason, that you brought today, this is a good chat.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you indulged me on it, because it's just like everything. If you peel back, why is Jason Cassidy opening his mouth? Because it is all about, I'm very curious as to how humans make the decisions that they make. Because it's clear that we not always do the thing that's in our best interest. We don't always eat the best food for us. We don't always go to the gym. We don't go to bed on time. We don't. And that peels over into business. It's like, it's okay. Why, like, information management? Why aren't we more proactive with it? It's, you know, it's, why don't we make better decisions with respect to this? And like, there's 100 human things that are all tied together that I think are all part of these fundamental motivations. They're all part of the way people make decisions, the way that people follow the crowd instead of doing, you know, individualized thinking and deciding, is what the crowd doing actually the optimal thing right now? And is it the least expensive? Because when you step back, you realize, okay, there are people who are going a different way, who are having a much better time than I am, who are spending less money doing it and all that. Why am I doing the orthodox old silly thing? So, and just people don't do that at all enough. And so I like it when conversations start to pick away at that.
Me too. Great, great chat as always. And I continue to be amazed by our ability to find overlapping topics completely accidentally. For the listener who doesn't know, we don't plan these ahead of time. We don't coerce collude with each other ahead of time. So I love that we have a habit of bringing overlapping topics together. It's really fun.
Enterprise Intelligence is a Shiny Docs podcast with Jason Cassidy and Davey Sliman, produced by Stephen Schuntz. Copyright 2024. If you would like to learn more about how Shiny Docs can make it easy to organize your content, protect your data, and make your users happy, visit shinydocs.com today.